This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening and welcome to Eco Radio KC. My name is Mike Murphy, and Natural E has the night off, so I'll be handling some of the news. Tonight, I'll look at climate resilience with Tom Jacobs of the Mid-America Regional Council, and also Jeff Barrow of Missouri River Relief will discuss their organization and their upcoming event. But first, we've got a couple of news items to share with you. So, KSHB Channel 41 reports that the GSA report on Bannister Complex's worker safety called insufficient. There's a new call for a congressional investigation, their report goes, into toxic chemical exposure at Kansas City's Bannister Complex. This was the federal complex at Bannister and Lydia, just east of Troost, that featured a weapons plant along with many other regular office plants, including GSA, the IRS was there for a while, and DFAS and many others. Multiple previous investigations found the federal complex contained hazardous chemicals. The plant used to manufacture nuclear weapons and airplane engines. Jim Daniels worked at Bannister in heating and air conditioning maintenance for 15 years. He says employees weren't properly protected as required by federal law. We were given no indication that any of these toxins existed, Daniels said. Him and his colleague, according to Channel 41's report, David Hendricks, who has since died, filed a whistleblower complaint to that effect, but a GSA, Government Service Agency's report, concluded that employees were properly protected. However, a letter from Special White House Counsel Carolyn Lerner, written to President Obama on Friday, October 30th, states that the GSA report is insufficient. These findings have been passed on to key congressional leaders. Rhonda Sella is the acting president for the American Federation of Government Employees, and that union represents GSA employees who work at Bannister. Sully says the union is now teaming up with Daniels. She's also calling for a congressional investigation of Bannister, and that's courtesy of Channel 41. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch on November 4th reported that Illinois Attorney General Madigan, Lisa Madigan, has joined the legal effort to support the power plant. Now, Illinois has joined now 17 states supporting new domestic power plant limits being challenged in federal court by more than two dozen other states. And Democracy Now! This morning reported, of course, Obama rejects Keystone XL, an historic win for environmental activism. The environmental movement is celebrating one of its biggest victories to date, President Obama's rejection of the Keystone XL oil pipeline. After years of review and one of the most vocal grassroots campaigns this country has seen in decades, Obama announced Friday he will not allow Keystone on his watch. The pipeline would have sent 830,000 barrels of crude every day from Alberta's oil sands to refineries on the U.S. Gulf Coast. The fight to block the pipeline saw activists chaining themselves to construction machinery along the pipeline's route, hundreds getting arrested in acts of civil disobedience outside the White House, hundreds of thousands taking part in the largest climate march in history, the People's Climate March, just over a year ago. And all that courtesy of Democracy Now! You can get their full report on that at democracynow.org. Now, that will do it for the news. Joining me here in the studio is Mr. Tom Jacobs of the Mid-America Regional Council. Tom, thanks.
Mike, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for being here. So, what brought you to my attention was this event you have coming up about climate resilience. First of all, tell us about maybe a little bit about Mid-America Regional Council and some of the things you told me in the green room about what got you to this point of.
Fantastic. So I work at MARC, or the Mid-America Regional Council. MARC is the regional planning organization for the metropolitan area. So what we do for a business is we bring people together that require collaborative solutions. So air quality, air doesn't stop at State Line Road, and water doesn't stop at the State Line Road. If we want to keep them clean, what we need to do is to bring people together from different local governments, from state agencies, from federal agencies, from other interested community groups, and figure out strategies that make sense to keep the air clean or the water clean, or to keep quality of life in our region as high as we can, and a variety of other fields of practice too, whether it has to do with transportation infrastructure or land use, open space protection, and a wide variety of other concerns.
And so you mentioned earlier how you got together with Johnson County, with Kansas City, and with Bridging the Gap, I think was the other partner in this, and
that's right.
Applied for a climate action champion.
That's right.
For the region. So explain that.
Absolutely. So it turns out there's a lot of people in Kansas City doing terrific work to advance agendas related to sustainability, environmental protection, in ways that are, just good for the community at large and good for the economy. Many of those folks work for Johnson County and Kansas City, Missouri, and Bridging the Gap. So we formed a consortium and replied to a solicitation that the Department of Energy issued, and were successful in our application. So we received a designation from the U.S. Department of Energy and from the White House as a climate action champion. And so the four of us are working together to try and figure out strategies to make Kansas City more resilient in the face of different kinds of extreme weather events that we might confront in the future. So I think maybe one thing that caught your attention is we've got a workshop scheduled for this Thursday afternoon at the Kauffman Foundation's Conference Center. And our intention is to bring people together and launch a conversation that helps begin to understand what the science is associated with climate change and what we might expect here in our community. And initiate a discourse with folks who are interested from the community about, well, what do we do to prepare? So our event on Thursday, we've invited a climatologist who's a professor at Iowa State University, who is the author of multiple reports around the Midwest for communities like Lawrence and Columbia and Lincoln and Dubuque, helping each of those communities appreciate what different climate scenarios might look like for their communities. And so he's going to share some of his findings about different climate scenarios that might be relevant to the Kansas City area, so that we can begin to build some agreement on what a potential future might look like for us, so that we can then begin policy and planning conversations that would help us prepare accordingly.
So you and I were talking outside earlier about the concept of heat islands, and that Kansas City is particularly vulnerable to that effect. Do you want to explain what a heat island is? It's kind of self-explanatory, but maybe.
Well, exactly. So maybe in downtown Kansas City, Missouri, it might be on a hot July or August day, maybe 5 or 6 or 7 degrees hotter than the surrounding countryside. So if it's hotter in an urban area, it'll take more energy to cool that place. And there might be opportunities, or there might be different kinds of vulnerabilities related to public health risks associated with elevated heat. There will be more energy consumption. There might be different kinds of threats posed to vegetation. And it's just not as nice when it's hot out, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's all kinds of things you can do to cool a city. And and the issue of, you know, a cool city becomes increasingly important as it starts to get hotter. And so maybe we're just talking about planting more trees, or we're talking about green roofs or white roofs, or we're talking about ways to restore creeks, or use water in creative kinds of ways to cool the city. Maybe there's different kinds of paving materials. There's all kinds of different strategies that can help help build a more sustainable community and cool a city, and ways that save money and reduce energy consumption and improve quality of life all at the same time. So we're just beginning to launch a study as part of our designation as a climate action champion, a study that we're conducting in partnership with a group of scientists from Lawrence Berkeley National Labs. And what these folks are going to do is they're going to try and establish a relationship between, you know, the urban heat and energy consumption. And from there, we're going to do cost-benefit analyses of different kinds of strategies that mitigate the problem, so that we can use that information to feed into policymaking and planning efforts and urban design strategies that help make our community more resilient in the face of changes to climate and so forth.
Yeah, so part of the your response to becoming a climate action champion is putting on these climate resilience workshops, the first of which is this week that you mentioned that Dr. Anderson will be.
That's right.
And so what's to explain climate resilience?
So, you know, as a country, we've seen all kinds of crazy weather patterns across the country. If it's water scarcity in California, or it's events like Sandy or Katrina, I wouldn't argue necessarily that those are a product of climate change, but it does seem increasingly clear that there's more extreme weather that we have to deal with, both in Kansas City and nationally. And so as we understand what the probabilities and vulnerabilities are of those kinds of events, we can try and prepare for it so we can bounce back more quickly, or as some might say, to bounce forward a little bit better. Mm. And so when we look at climate resilience, we think about, you know, what is it that makes our community more adaptable, more able to withstand different kinds of shocks to the system, be able to manage our resources more efficiently, minimize risks to all of the community, including some of the most vulnerable portions of our community, and use those kinds of strategies not only to minimize risks, but also to foster more sustainable kinds of development activities.
Okay. Okay, and so you've laid out these a set of workshops that you're going to take place. Like, so who's going to be attending these?
Well, we cast a broad net. This is one of the interesting things. This whole idea of climate change and climate resilience is really complicated. It's really hard. It's been hard for me to wrap my head around it because there's so many dimensions to the problem. And so to try and understand it, and then to try and prepare to be a more resilient community, you need to interact with lots of different people who think about these issues from different kinds of perspectives. So we'll have ecologists, people who are well-versed in how to manage forests or prairies or wetlands, people who are hydrologists who might think about water resource management strategies. We'll have representatives from electric utilities and water utilities. We'll have land planners. We'll have engineers who are responsible for building transportation infrastructure. We'll have elected officials. We'll have representatives from the nonprofit community, whether it's from Sierra Club or Bridging the Gap. We'll have representatives as well from some of the federal agencies, whether it's NOAA or the U.S. Geological Survey or EPA or the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. In short, we're trying to cast a broad net to involve anybody who might have an interest in joining us. I know there will be folks from the Chamber of Commerce who attend and others. And so what we want to do is initiate a conversation with a lot of different people who think about these problems in different sorts of ways, so we can bring different perspectives to bear and bring a lot of creativity to solving what's going to be a challenging problem for Kansas City and really the world at large and in the coming generations.
Okay, so tell us, first of all, if our listeners want to call in, the number to call is 816-931-5534 if you want to join in on this conversation with Tom Jacobs of the Mid-America Regional Council, or MARC. And Mark is having the first of several climate resilience workshops coming up this week. What else keeps you busy?
There's all kinds of things. One of the, you know, when I think about resilience and sustainability, what I'm really trying to do is to look for strategies that solve a lot of problems with a single dollar. And so my favorite example of this is planting a tree, or planting a lot of trees, or enhancing a whole region's forest. So if we plant more trees or increase the, or restore the urban forest, we're solving a whole lot of problems at once. We're going to be reducing urban heat islands and saving energy. We're going to be intercepting water that won't hit the ground or that will infiltrate into the ground more easily. So we're going to reduce stormwater runoff, reduce water pollution, and reduce the risk of flooding. At the same time, we create habitat. We create beautiful spaces. If we have more tree-lined streets, we'll have nicer places for people to walk. And as a result, we might have fewer emissions from people driving by themselves from one place to another. In short, there's so many reasons why one might want to plant more trees. And when you look at it from a sustainability or resilience perspective, that's one way to get after it. It turns out a few years ago, we did a study, an assessment of our region's forest for the 9-county metro area. And we have somewhere around 250 million trees in our 9 counties.
Really?
So huge numbers of trees, all different kinds of trees. The forest looks different in a forest in Ray County or Cass County than it might along a streetscape on Main Street here outside the studio. And these forests provide, according to the model that we used, $320 million a year of what we call ecosystem service benefits. So it's $320 million a year of clean air and public health and carbon sequestration and energy conservation, and not counting many of the other benefits that these forests provide. So it turns out if you plant more trees, you get more benefit, right? And clean air is something that's part of the commons, right? And it's easy. If you cut down a tree, you might not realize the clean air that you're losing. If we lose millions of ash trees from an emerald ash borer, not only are we losing the beauty of those trees in our neighborhoods, we're also losing a certain amount of clean air and clean water. So we're trying to figure out, well, how can we advance a comprehensive urban forestry strategy that helps provide all these different community benefits through different kinds of cooperative approaches. So one of our consortium partners is Bridging the Gap, who runs something called the Heartland Tree Alliance, which works with a lot of different folks here in town from the Missouri Department of Conservation and the Kansas Forest Service, urban foresters from a lot of different cities, from Kansas City Power and Light, and elsewhere. And they have hundreds and hundreds of volunteers who run classes, who plant trees, who try and figure out how to protect our urban forest. It's a kind of incredible strategy that results from a terrific partnership like the one that the Heartland Tree Alliance is managing. And we look for those kinds of things to, you know, help make our community better all the time.
I see. Yeah, I mean, you kind of mentioned this, but I've seen some areas where they specifically say, we're going to go in here and plant trees to replace what was lost by the ash blight, and a different choice. Is biodiversity like considered in that too? Like so, when a lot of streets were, you know, cities and suburbs were built 100 or 150 years ago, there was a maple street that had maple trees on it, and then an oak street that had oak trees on it, and sometimes in when cases like that, a whole street will lose its trees if there's a blight of just that kind of thing.
That's right.
So is that something of the past?
I love that you framed the whole question around the terminology of biodiversity.
Right? Yeah.
So if you have a whole tree of just ash trees and you have an exotic beetle that's capable of killing all those trees and you don't have anything else that's growing there, you're going to lose them all, right? And so
right.
If you have more different kinds of trees that are growing, you're going to have a more resilient, a healthier forest along that street. It turns out as we think about development or redevelopment in the community, the easiest thing to do is if you have a forest is to not cut it down, to protect the resources that you have. And so as I mentioned before, we have a lot of forests in our region. And so protecting or managing those those forests that we have left is a lot easier in planting new trees. If we were to replant every tree that we have in our region, the cost would be $93 billion. So obviously, we'll never have that kind of resources to replant, so it's best to take care of what we have. And as we're rebuilding streets or building new subdivisions or commercial areas or office areas, it's totally possible to think about environmentally sensitive design strategies that include trees, that include ecologically sensitive stormwater management strategies, that use green building techniques that conserve energy and provide for healthier indoor air quality, and so many other kinds of strategies, all of which, when you look at them together, make our community healthier. And as we're talking about climate resilience in our workshop on Thursday, you know, these would all be elements that would contribute to a more resilient community over the very long term.
If people are just hearing about this for the first time, is it too late to get involved in this workshop? Or
no, all of our events are open to the public. Anybody who'd like to join us is more than welcome. There's no cost to attend. The event will begin at 1 p.m. at the Kauffman's Foundation's Conference Center. And we just ask that you come a few minutes early so that you can check in and we can get started on time.
That's great. So people just need to show up. They don't need to call and register or anything. Or
it might help us a little bit if you registered online. You can go to marc.org and you can find where to register fairly easily. And if you don't have time to do it and you're interested, please join us. We'd love to have you. What we'll do is we'll have Dr. Chris Anderson from Iowa State kick us off with a presentation about the state of the science, the state of our understanding about potential climate change scenarios for Kansas City, looking out, you know, 50, 7,500 years. And then from there, we'll have a response panel with a number of area experts who are involved in different sectors, from housing to public health, economics, and the like. And then from there, we'll have a workshop kind of environment where we'll ask folks to engage in conversation to help us dig deeper into the issues.
Well, that sounds fascinating. It sounds like it's going to be well thought out. And
oh, it's going to be great. It's going to be fantastic. One of the things is when you work on a hard problem like this, the best way is to get a lot of smart people together in a room and work on it together. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to start a conversation and trying to deepen our understanding about what the problems are that confront us, and that'll lead us into ever deeper conversations about what do we do to solve the problems that we identify.
Well, so will the next workshop, the follow up to this, be literally a follow up, like standing on the shoulders of what was accomplished in the?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So we haven't yet pinned down the dates for the workshops that will follow, but we'll have two or three more that'll occur in the winter or spring months. And all of this work will culminate in what we hope will be the publication of a regional climate resilience strategy. So it wouldn't be a detailed plan that, say, a city public works department might need to figure out how much money they need to allocate for extra snow plowing, but it would be at a little bit higher level to think about, you know, what are we going to do about heat islands like we were talking about, or what are we going to do about potential risks to water resource management issues and so forth. There's a lot of different issues that we can chew on, and so we'll take those apart and look at them in more depth, and then try and come out with a set of integrated strategies that might help us then move on down the road towards more strategic planning and investment and action and implementation.
All right, we do have a caller. Caller, you're on the air. What's your name, or what part of town are you calling from?
It's a blind guy from the Villa Incognito here in Midtown. Mr. Environmentalist, it's a good subject, but on planting these trees, I hope you focus more on. And it started in the late 70s, 80s, but had starts and stops because it was hard to compete against the ornamental growth of trees produced in nurseries. But if you can get back to focusing on more native species. Now, sometimes people have to realize that because of transplanting and that, they come from 3 to 6 foot in height and that. But once they're established, they usually have a pretty good rate of growth and are non-invasive and, I shouldn't say that, some of them can be, but more adapted to your area. And now all of them wouldn't work for street trees, but they would have considerable consideration in taking us back to have healthy, sturdy trees. I mean, I was sickened by the emerald ash borer because the ash was, I think it was probably pretty common across America, and, you know, when they got hit by the emerald ash borer. But now the mistake they made in the American chestnut from Maine to the Carolinas, you know, they said you could walk on the treetops that was hit by a fungus, and their answer was to cut them all down. And they realized after they did it, they should have left them in, because, like, there's a birch, there's a borer resistant variety of birch, and the mother plant could be traced to a birch tree on the University of Wisconsin that just developed it naturally. I mean, it wasn't no GMO or anything else. So I'll take my answer out there. Peace out.
Thanks.
Well, I really appreciate your question, and I couldn't agree with you more. I know that there's, in the forestry community, I think there's broad agreement that we want to use native species wherever we can, and it really speaks to trees and other perennial plants as well, as we think about opportunities to use native landscaping to beautify our environment and enhance the environmental or ecological health of our landscapes. The trees will last longer, they'll be healthier, they're more adapted to our place. And so you're right, we want to use native trees. One of the interesting things that we have to look at in the face of climate change is it could be that we'll be looking at different kinds of, we'll be redefining what native means over time, and that's something that will be worth a good hard look.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah, so thanks for that call. And Tom Jacobs, our time has gone by. Thank you so much for coming in tonight. If people want to find out more about your activities, just go to the website or...
Mike, well, first, thanks for having me. I appreciate it a lot. And we've got a whole lot of information on our website, at marc.org. And if you'd like more information, feel free to call me at Mark. Our line is 816-474-4240. We've got a lot of staff that can help answer your questions if I'm not available as well. So, again, Mike, thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you, Tom. All right.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. You may not think about how global warming affects your bowl of Cheerios, but General Mills Chief Sustainability Officer Jerry Lynch does.
We know that climate change has the potential to play a key role in one of the most important parts of our business, agriculture, which is where we source all of our ingredients from. Whether it's through drier soils or more frequent severe weather or migration of growing regions.
And in a vicious cycle. Producing that cereal is making the problem worse by contributing to climate change. So to lessen the company's impact, General Mills has reduced carbon pollution from its processing plants by more than 10% in the last decade. But since the ingredients and packaging materials used by General Mills generate nearly two-thirds of the company's carbon pollution, General Mills also wants to help its suppliers become more sustainable. For example, the company has joined Field to Market, the Alliance for Sustainable Agriculture, which includes members ranging from seed companies to cereal producers to grocery stores. Lynch says collaborations like this and others can help drive reductions in carbon pollution and help limit global warming at all stages of the supply chain. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
To commemorate the centennial of World War I and its many veterans, we present the original audio drama, Never Again War, The Sacrifice of Kata Kollwitz. Hosted by Marcia Mason, Never Again War takes us into the mind and life of the great German graphic artist and sculptor, renowned for her body of work depicting the lives of the working poor and the tragedy of war. Tune in for Never Again War, The Sacrifice of Kata Kollwitz.
On the next Thursday night special at 7 p.m.
The Missouri Legislative Black Caucus and the Jackson County Bar Association present Law 101, free legal classes taught by judges and licensed attorneys. The next class, Juvenile Law, is November 10th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Mary L. Kelly Center, located at 2803 East 51st Street, Kansas City, Missouri. For more information, please call 816-651-0044. This is a public service announcement of 90.1 KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
teaching kids to save water on this current cast. Hear the pitter-patter of little feet around your house? If so, you can teach your children to keep their water footprint small, even as they grow in size. The key is to make water conservation fun and simple. Try approaching it like a game. For example, help your kids read the meter and then see if your family can use less from week to week. Set goals and rewards for success. When your children brush their teeth, show them how to shut off the faucet so it does not drip. Teach older kids to take shorter showers and set an example by practicing water conservation yourself. These simple lessons can help your kids develop lifelong habits and an appreciation for our natural resources. Support for Current Cast comes from the Mitsubishi Corporation Foundation for the Americas. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
And you're tuned to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is Eco Radio KC. Big thanks again for Tom Jacobs of Mid-America Regional Council for checking in. And now we've got some folks from Missouri River Relief here. First of all, on the phone, we have Jeff Barrow. Jeff is the executive director. Is that the right title?
Yeah, I'm director of Missouri River Relief, and I'm really happy to be on the air tonight. Thank you.
Oh, well, thanks. And you're in Columbia, is that right?
Yeah, we're headquartered in Columbia, but we work up and down the Missouri River from Yankton, South Dakota, down to the Mississippi River.
Okay. And are you guys able to hear him? You're not? Okay. You can hear him. Okay. Well, while Dave is also here in the studio is Dave Stouse. He's with Missouri River Relief as well. And how are you, sir?
Doing fine, thanks.
All right, great. And also in the studio here is Scott Mansker, who, and Scott, your organization is Missouri 340?
Yeah, I'm with River Miles. We put on River Miles. Missouri River 340 canoe race, yeah.
Okay, so River Miles is the name of the organization and Missouri 340 is the...
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha. All right, and so first of all, I'm wondering maybe if you guys can explain what Missouri River Relief is. Tell us about this organization.
Well, River Relief is a not-for-profit organization. Like you said, we're headquartered in Columbia, Missouri. And our mission is to connect people to the Missouri River so they can make a difference in their communities. And the main thing we do is organize volunteer cleanups of trash in the beaches and woods along the river. And we also do educational boat trips and days on the river and watershed festivals and a whole variety of education events. But the main thing we do is get people out in the river and let them realize what it is and how it's connected to their lives.
So are you guys, like, organized in chapters or is it, like, just one statewide?
No, it's one organization. We have about 36 hardcore volunteers who help us, conduct events. And we have friends and allies and partners up and down the river, like I said, about 800 river miles from the Gavin's Point Dam, the free-flowing river that comes down to the Mississippi.
Okay, wow. That's pretty amazing. And so you guys have a gala benefit this week, Thursday night, is that right?
Right, this Thursday night we're celebrating some river heroes because we have a small staff and a small core group of individuals who conduct our events, but we can't do it without literally hundreds of partners and sponsors up and down the river, and so we want to recognize two river heroes who are living or concentrated in Kansas City area.
Okay. And so this is to raise funds for the organization, is that correct?
Well, not necessarily. We're more trying to raise friends for the organization.
Okay,
and we
okay.
want to shine a spotlight on our Educator of the Year and our Sponsor of the Year. And we typically have an awards, we always have an awards ceremony every year in Columbia, but we wanted to reach out so we could go into the home communities and let their friends, families, and colleagues know that, in our eyes, at least, they're river heroes.
That's great. And Scott, so you're going to be emceeing this event.
Yeah, that's what I hear. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, that's great. And have you done anything like this before? Or?
I mean, I guess a little bit here and there. I'm a school teacher, so I'm used to standing up in front of people and trying to get them to listen to me. So, you know, this can't be that much different, except the food will be better.
And remind our listeners where this is going to be.
This will be in the Faultless Event Space. It's in the West Bottoms. It's a historic building, the Faultless Starch Building. It's in the West Bottoms.
Yeah, okay.
I can't remember the address right now.
Okay.
You should have it right
1009 West 8th Street.
Thanks, Jeff.
1009 West 8th Street. It's as close as the river as we could get. We're a river organization, and ideally we would be doing this on the river, but in November, the weather's kind of chancy.
Yeah, it is. So why don't you guys share with us a little bit of what makes the Missouri River special?
Wow, how long do you got? I mean, we could go on and on. I mean, the thing that leaps to mind to me is that it's in our backyard. That's what makes it special to me. I mean, I can, you know, drive 10 minutes and put a boat in the water and be in utter and complete wilderness, just a few paddle strokes outside of Kansas City. I think people have this picture in their mind of what the river is. They just, you know, you only hear bad news about the river on TV. You hear that there was some sort of a leak or something, or you hear that there was a body found, or you hear that the river's flooding, and that's, you know, the type of news you receive. But you don't ever hear like, wow, the water you drank today came from the Missouri River and it keeps you alive and
right.
and it's this beautiful place with sandbars and beaches and islands right in your backyard that very few people know about or understand how to access.
Yeah, and anything to add to that, Dave?
Well, additionally, Kansas City's here because of the river.
Right.
The river was our means of transportation. I think now the river has become an inconvenience to people. They have to wait in line to cross the bridge, and they fail to realize what a wonderful resource this river is. Over 40% of the Missourians get their drinking water from the Missouri River. Not only that, it provides recreation, as Scott was saying, both canoes and fishermen. There's a great fishing community that goes out on the river, and there's more and more canoes and kayaks out on the river now that they're finding out the access points, and due to some of Scott's work, his races started, I think, 10 years ago. I think 17 entries in the first year.
Yeah.
Last year there was over 400 entries.
Man.
Yeah, so the secret's sort of leaking out that we have this, you know, great resource. But River Relief, what they've done over their 15 years is they've had, and correct me, jump in if I'm wrong, Jeff, but over 20,000 volunteers, you know, putting them face-to-face with the Missouri River, touching it, smelling it, cleaning it. And I think over 15,000 school children or educational trips for kids, you know, where kids have been able to have this experience. So they're making a huge impact. Like he said, we're picking up trash, but the most important part of the mission is we're getting people to understand and have stewardship over their river.
Right.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I would say 20,000 volunteers, more than 20,000 we've taken out. And 80 to 90% of them have never been on the Missouri River before. It's a first-time experience for them, and it's just astounding to see them going out on the river a little wide-eyed and wondering about it because, like Scott said, most people have heard nothing but bad news about the Missouri River. And when they come back from the cleanup, they form teams. They're smiling. They're telling stories about what they found and the challenge they met in getting this stuff out of the river. And it's just a remarkable transformation. And like Scott said, people then have a sense of ownership of the river, and we're hoping that then they will pay attention to it and advocate for it, making it a better place.
Wow. You guys are making me really want to go out on the river.
We'll take you.
Yeah, we can arrange that.
Yeah, but can you arrange for me to come back, too?
Definitely.
You may not want to, but, yeah, we can bring you back.
Yeah.
We've taken more than 20,000 people out, and there was only one person that we left out longer than she expected. So we learned our lesson, and we have, you know, everyone who goes out comes back and comes back with a good experience.
Yeah, that's great.
Another number that's significant in our 14, 15-year history, we've picked up over, our volunteers and us have picked up over 800 tons of trash off the Missouri River.
Wow, that is something to be proud of.
It is.
Yeah,
and that's over that 800-mile stretch that Jeff mentioned from South Dakota to St. Louis. So, I mean, that's a ton per mile, per river mile, has been pulled off the river. So it's pretty amazing when you think of it that way.
What we normally find is plastic bottles, and so really it takes a lot of plastic bottles to make a ton.
Yeah, really. Yeah, I bet that's true. What's the biggest problem facing the Missouri River, you guys think?
I think it's, you know, all the stuff we put in the watershed that we act like we don't think this is going to end up in the watershed. And if that's chemicals on your lawn or the overuse of some chemicals in agriculture, this is affecting, you know, our water quality. The farming of animals and livestock in the watershed is also a problem. These are all things that are workable and can be addressed and are being addressed by people who have good stewardship over their land, which is most people. But I think just, you know, people, when they have good information, they make good decisions. And so it's really just about giving people good information so they can make those good decisions. And that's part of River Relief's mission, is just outreach, awareness, helping people understand that even if you live 30 miles from the river, the stuff you put on your lawn is going to make it to the river. It's going to be in our drinking water. So then when people have that information, they'll make good decisions.
And what Scott's saying is pretty much invisible. You know, most of the pollutants in the river you can't really see, but that's one thing that when picking up trash, you can definitely see it. You can feel it. You have a challenge to get it out. And a typical cleanup will take 100 to 200 people on the river, and they'll pick up 5 to 10 tons of trash. And that's, you know, you can't argue against that. I mean, that's a huge pile of what the people in the Missouri River watershed are giving back to the river. And like what Dave was saying, I mean, 40% of the people in Missouri get their drinking water from the Missouri River itself. But there are also electric power plants up and down the river that provide electricity to people. And there are sand dredgers that provide sand for concrete. So when you're walking on a sidewalk, 80% of the sand and concrete has come from the bottom of the Missouri River. And very few people realize how their lives are connected to the river and dependent upon the river. And the main thing we give back is not so good, like Scott was saying. It's chemicals that don't help the river or its life.
And you guys can't really help. Like, you can pull out plastic bottles out of the river, but you can't pull out chemicals out of the river, right? You guys really are powerless to do anything about that, or
right,
but other than educate.
Yeah, but in the bigger picture, you're exposing thousands of people to the river and helping them understand that concept that everything is downstream. And so then maybe they make a different decision about whether their dandelions are worth, you know, napalming or whatever they have to do. I mean, so you're giving them the information they need. Now the river is not an abstraction to them. It's something that they've actually been to, and they've picked trash up off it, and they feel some pride in it, and so now they make decisions differently.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, you talked about downstream, and you know, it's a whole concept, you know, in environmental awareness that everybody's downstream,
right,
ultimately, and speaking, you know, the Mississippi River is downstream of the Missouri, and the Gulf of Mexico is downstream of that.
You got it.
Yeah. And one thing that has been a little bit of frustration for me as a transplant to Kansas City, like, I think Kansas City tries to, you know, well, maybe it's inadvertent, but hides its river, hides the river both from a natural perspective and from a, you know, historical heritage perspective. I mean, there's the Berkeley Park, which was a big deal that, you know, they acknowledged the river, you know, and then over on the Kansas City, Kansas side, there's that Caw Point Park where the two rivers meet, the confluence there. But it doesn't really, for the most part, Kansas City ignores the river. Is that, do you guys feel that frustration too, or?
Yeah, I mean, that's a result of, you know, decades of decisions made by, you know, where are we going to put the railroad tracks? How are we going to give access to the river? And we have truly sort of turned our back on it. But I think that that's beginning to change. And the two places you mentioned, Caw Point Park and Berkeley Riverfront Park, are the beginning of that change that we're witnessing. I think those are very positive things. And now I'm hearing plans about, you know, some housing, apartments, and things like that that are looking to be built with views to the river. There's always talk about marinas and things we could do because we have the template from some of our upstream neighbors in Omaha and Iowa area that have done this. They have embraced their river with great success.
And there are towns downstream that show that too. Washington, Missouri has built a wonderful park and has boat ramps and actually a boat club along their riverfront. They also have a railroad as well, but they're able to, you know, accommodate that. But you're right, Kansas City has flood walls, railroads, very steep and rip-rappy banks, and it's difficult to actually get close to the river in Kansas City.
Yeah, which is ironic, since, like, as you mentioned earlier, that's the reason we have Kansas City is because of the river. That's what.
Right. I think we're at a tipping point where we're going to start seeing, you know, some savvy development start to happen, because, you know, what better place for a restaurant, what better place for a loft apartments than with that incredible view? And it's only getting better from here, as far as we can tell. I mean, in the last 10 to 15 years, there's been dramatic improvement. When I first got on the river, gosh, it was 1989. I don't even know how many years ago that is now, but there was nobody out there. I mean, I spent a week on it and I never saw anyone in a canoe. I saw maybe two guys fishing. And now you cannot get out on the river on a weekend without seeing tons of guys catfishing, people paddling up and downstream. It's a lot different now than it was.
And I've heard people that have crossed over the Missouri River bridges in Kansas City, and they look down and they think it's a lake, like Lake of the Ozarks. They didn't even realize that that's a river, and that's the Missouri River that's flowing through our city.
Yeah, I guess that's my point, is that it's kind of like, you know, it's not embraced by the city, except, that, you know, in these couple examples we've cited. I mean, you guys are at one example of a group that are embracing the river. That's basically what your organization is about, is right, embracing the river and sharing that embrace with new people. Is that a fair way of saying it?
Yes.
That's absolutely
the mission.
Yeah, we're
river huggers. I guess you could say that. We love the river.
Right. Yeah. That's right.
But River Relief, yeah, one thing that makes it unusual is that we operate five boats. So we have like a little Missouri River Navy, and that allows people to get out on the river. You know, it's like you were saying, it's difficult access. It's difficult to find. And so with our boats and equipment and crews, you know, that's how we've been able to get more than 20,000 people out on the river.
That's incredible. So what I'm interested in the, like, the mechanics of, like, you know, you cited all this tonnage and trash that was removed. What's that like? Do you, you know, have a canoe with pulling a barge behind it with, like, how much can you load into a canoe?
Well, we have done canoe-based cleanups, but even when we do that, the people connect, go to the shores and collect the trash, and then we'll come up afterwards with our motorboats, you know, like dump trucks, and then we'll haul that trash away.
Okay.
We've for our 10th anniversary, we did have a trash barge that we filled up with 60 tons of trash.
Wow.
But it's difficult operating a barge on the Missouri River, so we essentially just come out in our trailerable motor boats and take people out. Well, the first thing we do is we set up a camp, and then we scout the river so we know where the trash is accumulated. Because if you get 200 people show up in the morning and want to get out in the river, you need to be safe and efficient in getting them out. So we scout and map the river the day before, and we know where the trash sites are and where the difficult sites are, and then we can really fine-tune the cleanup and get people out. But it's not unusual for us in 30 minutes to get 200 people out on the river. And we also do that because the Department of Conservation and the Army Corps of Engineers and Fish and Wildlife Service partners with us, and they'll bring their boats out to help get that many people out on the river. And typically, people are only picking up trash for maybe 3 hours, you know, and then they come back for lunch. And after lunch is when we haul all that trash back. They pile the trash up on shore before lunch, and they come back, you know, have lunch. We usually have a trash contest during lunch, and then afterwards we haul all that back, and then we have to separate it. You know, we usually have a trailer for scrap metal. The tires have to go into a separate stream for recycling, and then if we can, we'll try to recycle as much of the plastic, glass, and aluminum as we can, but the rest of it goes to the landfill.
Wow. Wow. So you guys, after all these years, have kind of got it down to a science now.
Yeah, I've heard people describe this as a well-oiled machine.
Well, that's great. Well, guys, if anyone wants to, hears our conversation and wants to join in the next time you guys have such a fun expedition, how do they go about doing that?
Well, the best way to check into us is on a website. We're riverrelief.org. That's one word. And we also have a Facebook page for River Relief. And that would be a way also, if someone wanted to come to the River Heroes Gala, they could go on our website or our Facebook and check into the details of that.
Okay, that's great. And any other final comments before we...
I would like to... discuss our education program.
Okay.
It is education taking folks out on the river, but we're focusing also on school kids also. We're taking Good. School kids out on the river with programs that we call Day on the River, where they'll come down to the river. We'll have local scientists down to talk with them, but we'll take half of the group out on the river in the morning, give them a river experience. The other half is on the ground talking with some of our local scientists about river ecology, science, river science, what they can do. And then after lunch, we switch groups and take this second group out on the river. So this has been a very successful program. One of our river heroes is Tony Jean Dickerson with Benjamin Banneker Charter School, and she's passionate about the hands-on environmental education that we're giving her students. We've taken her students out for 3 years now, and we're proud of that connection that we have with Benjamin Banneker, and we're trying to increase our presence in education.
That's great. Yeah, thanks, Dave. And Scott Mansker, Jeff Barrow, Dave Stouse, thank you guys so much for joining us tonight on Eco Radio KC. And good luck once again. That event is at the Faultless Event Space in the historic West Bottoms this Thursday, starting at 6:30. Is that right?
We've moved it up to 6 o'clock.
Oh, 6 o'clock. Okay. And we're going to go out with This Week in Water. And thank you, Jeff. We appreciate you calling in from Columbia.
All right, we'll see you on the river.
All right.
See you on the river.
Is climate change causing stronger storms? That answer coming up in other stories for the week ending November 8th, 2015. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Last week, the Keystone XL pipeline was in the headlines First, when the company that wanted to build it asked for a delay of any decision by the Obama administration whether to approve it.
But despite TransCanada's request for a delay, on Thursday, the Obama administration decided to nix the controversial pipeline.
The defeat of the project may be more symbolic than anything. Oil producers can still ship tar sands oil by rail and other pipelines through the U.S., and currently there are three major pipelines planned to transport Alberta tar sands oil through Canada.
Many environmental groups remain focused on the fact that Canadian tar sands oil production is continuing, and they're also concerned about plans in the U.S. to develop tar sands in eastern Utah.
Tar sands development is very much an issue about water. The process uses a lot of water and is itself energy intense. The bitumen is locked in clay and sand, and about 3 barrels of water are used to produce 1 barrel of oil. Sometimes steam is used to extract the oil from sand and clay underground.
More than 90% of the water used ends up as toxic waste dumped in massive pools that contain carcinogenic substances like cyanide.
The oil industry is downplaying the significance of the Obama administration's Keystone XL decision, saying things like U.S. imports of oil from Canada won't be affected, and tar sands oil is now more likely to be shipped by rail.
But environmental groups are celebrating the power of social movements to accomplish political change.
A climate warming crisis continues to occur in Indonesia. Many fires have been set in order to clear land for paper and palm oil plantations, and the carbon that has been released is making the country one of the world's worst polluters.
Bloomberg estimates that at times in the past few weeks, the fires have spewed out as much carbon as the entire U.S. economy, which is 20 times the size of Indonesia's.
The blazes are occurring in peatland forests, which are unique wetland ecosystems and home to threatened species. Many animals have been affected, including elephants, orangutans, tigers, and even bees.
In the past, the forests acted as carbon sinks or carbon absorbers until, of course, they were burned.
It is usual for fires to be set in Indonesia. However, some are saying that the situation this year has been worsened by the El Niño weather phenomenon, which has intensified the dry season. After every major weather event, such as a hurricane or a blizzard, it seems that we ask ourselves the same question. Is this the result of climate change?
A group of scientists from the American Meteorological Association seek to answer this question each year, and they just released the fourth edition of their findings, this one about storms that occurred in 2014.
Among the conclusions for America and Canada, human-caused climate change made the tropical cyclones that hit Hawaii much more likely, and also played a role in the flooding that happened in the Canadian prairies.
But lest you think that all major events were caused by climate change, scientists found that colder temperatures in the eastern U.S. and extreme winter storms across the country in 2014 were a result of more normal weather patterns.
However, the report did find that greenhouse emissions and other human activities influenced heavy rainfall in Europe, drought in East Africa, and heat waves in Australia, Asia, and South America. And they found that the overall probability of wildfires in the western U.S. has been increased due to human effects on climate.
West Coast Dungeness crab season opens November 15th, or at least that's the traditional opening date, but not this year.
California state officials have closed both recreational and commercial fishing for Dungeness and rock crab from Santa Barbara to the Oregon border due to a toxic algal bloom that might be related to warmer ocean temperatures brought by El Nino and the so-called blob.
The blob phenomenon is an area of high atmospheric pressure that's been hovering over the Pacific Northwest and is responsible for creating a warm area of ocean water that encourages algal growth and, along with it, higher amounts of a dangerous neurotoxin, domoic acid.
Algae naturally produces domoic acid as a way to deter predators, but this year's growth has been a record breaker.
And typically the blooms occur for a few weeks, but this one's lasted all summer and has impacted ecosystems from California to Alaska.
Eaten by krill, anchovies, sardines, and other small fish, the toxins work their way up the food chain. Particularly hard hit have been marine mammals such as sea lions.
The Marine Mammal Center in the San Francisco Bay Area has already seen 213 sea lions affected by domoic acid poisoning this year. The toxin attacks the brain of the animals, causing lethargy, disorientation, seizures, and if not treated, death. Finally, is there something fishy going on in the seafood business? The advocacy group Oceana says we're being taken, hook, line, and sinker.
In a recent investigation, they showed that, for example, one-third of fish served in restaurants in Brussels were different from what was advertised on the menu.
Using DNA testing, they found that fish, such as cod or sole, were being substituted by cheaper farmed species. Overall, the most common mislabeling was with tuna. Cheaper yellowfin or big-eye tuna were being passed off as expensive bluefin.
And the problem isn't confined to Europe. Last month, Oceana released a study that revealed mislabeling of America's favorite fish, salmon. They collected 82 samples from restaurants and grocery stores and found that 43% were mislabeled.
Beth Lowell, senior campaign director at Oceana, said that not only are consumers getting ripped off, but this type of seafood fraud can have serious ecological consequences.
And to that end, we have good news to report. President Obama signed bipartisan legislation last week which included a number of provisions that will prevent illegally harvested fish from entering the U.S. and will also support efforts to achieve sustainable fisheries around the world.
In the meantime, Oceana has recommendations for consumers to avoid getting duped, such as buying seafood in season, looking at labels, and checking the price. If it's a bargain that seems too good to be true, it probably is, and you've fallen victim to the classic bait and switch. This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more at coloradowaterwise.org.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Están escuchando KKFI 90.1 FM Kansas City, Radio de la Comunidad. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City.